all diets fail at 6 months because people cannot go forever being hungry. Nobody can. Read the starvation studies. People cannot deprive themselves of food for that amount of, for more than a few months, really. And so they start to regain weight.
Well, hey everyone, Dr. David Perlmutter here. Welcome again to our program, The Empowering Neurologist. One of my heroes in the world of nutrition is Nina Teicholz. We've had her on the program before. She wrote an amazing New York Times bestseller called The Big Fat Surprise and really did so much to open our eyes to the notion that we've been led down the wrong path as it related to dietary fat. Now, of course, it's been a revolution to write a previous revolution that we are now recognizing we need fat in our diet. As a matter of fact, fat is very, very good for us. Of course, the discussion would then center on what type of fat. But Nina has really been extremely vocal in getting the message out that the incredible trend towards refined carbohydrates in the American, the Western, and now in the global diet is fraught with health consequences. And she's made it very clear. She remains extremely vocal and is very active, as you will soon learn. So let me tell you a little bit about Nina a little bit more. Nina Teicholz is a science journalist and an author, as I mentioned, of The Big Fat Surprise, which upended the conventional wisdom on dietary fat, especially saturated fat and seed oils. She is the founder of the Nutrition Coalition, which is a nonprofit organization working to ensure that nutrition policy reflects the very best and the most current science. She's appeared on most major TV networks, and her work has been published in places like The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, as well as in academic journals, including the BMJ and the Journal of the National Academy of Sciences, one of the most well-respected peer-reviewed journals that we turn to. She's a graduate of Stanford and Oxford universities and is now the author of the Unsettled Science column hosted on Substack. So I'm really delighted to welcome Nina back to our program. Let's get started. Well, Nina, it's so great to see you. It took some doing to get this podcast together, didn't it?
Yeah, just a bit on both our ends, yeah. I think. But good to see you.
That's right. Mother Nature tried to conspire, but we prevailed. In the intro, I described you as being a very important mentor for me and applauded you for your outreach, for what you're doing. It's so necessary. And, you know, that'll be a theme throughout our time together today. I want to start out, you blogged about and shared your experiences and your thoughts on a Lancet paper from 2019 that really, I think, the intent was to settle once and for all the question about what we should eat. And really, I think came to conclusions that are not necessarily perhaps what you and I would think are totally validated as it relates to science. So how do we unpack what they put forth, and then what should we do in terms of messaging?
So it's interesting that you bring up, this is a paper from 2019. Maybe we should let your listeners know why that paper is still important. It was called the Eat Lancet Report, and it really came out of an effort that's been mainly in Europe, but it's backed by the World Economic Forum. And it's their proposal for what they call a universal reference diet, which is the diet for everybody on Earth, and according to them. And it was put forward, they had a bunch of commissioners, I think 37 or 38. It's not too fresh in my mind right now, but they I did an analysis of that commission panel. It was, I would say 78-79% were people who had published and committed themselves to a entirely plant-based or mostly plant-based diet, either for nutritional, but more often for environmental reasons. So the paper really was about trying to shift the diet to largely grain-based. Okay, so if my memory serves correctly, it was 60 or 70% of the diet was grains. So it wasn't
the bottom of the food pyramid.
Yeah, as it existed. Bigger bottom of the food. I mean, it's basically the food pyramid with a very fat bottom. And so it wasn't, even though it was sort of portrayed as fresh fruits and vegetables, there was hardly any fruits in there, not so many vegetables, more sort of legumes and grains. And I think what was really noticeable about it was that the amount of animal foods in the diet was so minuscule. I think that the amount of red meat you were allowed was maybe like this much, like half a gram a day or maybe a gram a day. I mean, and similarly for eggs, there was maybe a little more chicken allowed. But that report was motivated by the desire for climate change and what I think is the erroneous belief that we should, as a first measure of course, change our diets as a way of saving the planet, because we can all agree we want to prevent climate change from taking over and ruining our Earth for all of us. But to balance carbon and methane on the backs of humans as a first measure is, I think, mistaken. I mean, you could do a lot by reducing the contributions of oil and gas, of chemical plants, of, you know, most of the methane, which is pinned on cows, actually comes from natural gas exploitation. So we're consumers. I mean, the public is being told that we have to sacrifice, arguably, our health, our well-being.
Right.
Part of my response was to document the huge number of multinational corporations behind this work. Just like every name, you know, Unilever, Nestle, PepsiCo, many chemical companies, many of the companies that stand to profit if the blame for climate change is pinned on us consumers for the meat that we are eating. So I think it's a very unfortunate trend that we have seen now going on for some years, which is to sort of convince consumers that this is the one thing that they can do. Because there's not an abundant amount of evidence, but there is in the clinical trials and observational studies that we see that when meat is removed from the diet the other side of that, which is when meat is added to the diet of, for say, starving children in Africa, tremendous gains are seen, right? Just giving them some whole complete proteins makes them do much better at school, do better in the playground, show more leadership skills, just all around be much healthier just by small additions of meat to the diet, which are not equaled if you add the same amount of protein in dairy or some other form of calories.
But the presentation was that 37 of the world's top nutritional scientists came together and really formulated a broad scope recommendation for planetary health and came up with this conclusion that we need to eat more grain.
Right.
Did I say that? I'll say it again. We need to eat more grain as the bottom of our pyramid and, you know, basically a plant-based diet because it's best for our health. Oh, and BTW, that's going to be the best thing for the planet as well. Everybody wins. We save the planet and we save our health. And I think that your contention is that on both counts, that recommendation is flawed. I mean, what you just said about meat, you know, the contra to this is that, well, raising cattle for meat or other forms of meat, it has huge environmental consequences. Therefore, if we give it up, the planet will be saved. Not even to consider what's happening with hydrocarbon burning and fracking and the inefficiency of factories and automobiles, et cetera, having logarithmic increased impact in terms of the environment, then the fact that there are animal sources of protein available to humans. And it's we look then at the USDA's recommendation, 5-year recommendation. Similarly, I think you would agree, was highly influenced by industry, let's call it like it is, in terms of the recommendation that having up to 10% of your calories derived from sugar was okay. Mm-hmm. And I think what you've been so masterful about over the years is letting people understand follow the money, that what's going on behind the scenes in terms of the recommendations from seemingly beneficent organizations is really highly motivated by industry and not by science. And that's where, you know, you've stood up head and shoulders above the crowd and said, hey, here's what's going on, and here's what the science really shows. Tell us about what the science was, what the scientists were telling the United States Department of Agriculture when it came time to formulate their five-year plan.
Are you talking about the U.S. Dietary Guidelines for Americans?
Correct.
Okay, so those were launched on the American public in 1980. And just as a little scene setter, obesity in America at that point was 14% of the total population for adults. Then we were told, starting in 1980, that food pyramid is no longer the food pyramid, but you know that's the visual that I think most people understand. That big bottom slab was originally 6 to 12 servings of grains per day, and now it's down to 6. But that 6 servings of grains per day still includes 3 servings of refined grains, right? So donuts is part of our advised diet, and up to 10% of calories is sugar, as you said. This policy is supposedly updated every 5 years by bringing in a supposedly, theoretically, outside independent group of experts, and they are supposed to review the science from the past 5 years. Well, I have just done exhaustive reviews of these various these various iterations of the guidelines and discovered, like, for instance, I mean, just extraordinary discoveries. I'll just share a few of them with you. One paper that we had come out last year, in which I was an author, was that 95% of this outside expert committee called the Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee for the 2015 guidelines, the one we're currently living with, 95% had a tie with a food or pharmaceutical corporation. More than half of that 20-person committee had more than 30 such ties. One person had 151 ties. And, you know, there was a person there who had been the former director, a former global director at Merck, a pharmaceutical company. There had been the former president of the Danon Institute, which promotes mainly now low-fat yogurts. And so, I mean, these people have been deeply involved in industry, and yet they're the experts that are in charge. So we also
it's breathtaking. And we could stop there and just let that one hang over our heads a little bit.
True.
That the people who are offering us up these doctrines that influence what the military does, what school lunches provide, are deeply tied, as you just described, to industry. And it's in their interest to fan the flames of the ratification of products that are not necessarily in our health interest.
Yeah, it is. It's important to underscore for people who don't know and think this is just some abstract government policy, just how all important it is. It's required by law to be followed by all federal programs. So as you say, the military, all, you know, VA hospitals, all food, school lunches, feeding programs for the elderly, women and infant children, food baskets. They're taught in all medical schools to all healthcare practitioners who are considered the, you know, the gold standard. And, you know, what is the result? The result is that if you go to and look at those food baskets for women and infant children, they literally have like Kix cereal, frosted mini wheat cereals, juices. They just are, I mean, we are absolutely setting up our population for failed metabolic health. And clearly food institutions are deeply embedded in this process. I told you about this outside committee of experts inside the USDA, which is the main agency, federal agency that leads the guidelines. They have more than 100 partnerships with these companies. So where they have these they're in partnership with them. So what does that, you know, what does that mean? PepsiCo has a whole healthy choice menu for kids where they're getting fed nachos, Doritos, Fritos, Tostados, or Tostitos. I mean, this is, it's a real fusion of corporate interest and supposedly our public health institutions, you know, they're supposed to be acting in our public interest, have clearly been captured by these extremely powerful corporate interests.
you know, the main threat of the recommended dietary approach was that it's extremely high in refined carbohydrates. When I say extremely high, I mean, for those of us in the field, we would all consider it to be extremely high. And there's been such a large number of studies that have come out in the last couple of years where people are starting to become familiar with the term ultra-processed.
Right.
We're linking ultra-processed foods to Alzheimer's risk, dementia risk in general, ovarian cancer, certainly metabolic conditions, as if Alzheimer's were not, but diabetes and obesity and dyslipidemia and hypertension, et cetera. And yet, recently, we've learned that 58% of the calories consumed by Americans is derived from ultra-processed foods that you would know come in a package with an ingredient list and are most likely sweetened. So, you know, and here we're getting government influence telling us this is the way to go. It's good for industry. It's good for bottom line. America's GDP continues to thrive and everybody's happy. But the downstream consequences for health and environmental impact, I think, are profound. At its core, though, we come up against the notion of low carbs, high carbs, low fat, high fat. I mean, let's try to distill that as best we can, because I think a rallying point for you over years has been that the more good, let's make sure we get that across, good dietary fat in our that we consume, the closer we get to a more ketogenic program and away from a diet that's fundamentally based from a calorie perspective on carbohydrates, seems to be better for us. Though I recall there was a recent Lancet study indicating that going low carb is associated with a variety of health threats, including all-cause mortality. I think it was a Harvard study published in Lancet, picked up by several of the news services. So you've been, I think, very defensive, rightfully, with respect to a more ketogenic diet, a more fat-based diet with restriction of carbohydrates. So how do you get to that point? What caused you to, you know, initially latch on to this notion that has become so trendy? But what is it about this notion of less carbs and more fat that you found so attractive to write your book, for example, and all that you seem to be doing today?
So, you know, when I started off this journey of trying to understand nutrition science now some 20 years ago, I was a vegetarian and I was cooking my own bread and I was into the idea of healthy carbohydrates, whole grains. I mean, that was my diet. I avoided red meat. Then I spent almost a decade researching for my book, a book that I started off writing a book about trans fats. And then part of the way through, my editor said, you know, I think you're writing a book about saturated fats and the way that we had gotten the good fat, bad fat paradigm completely.
That's a good editor right there.
Head. Yes, she was. And she said, you're making an argument that we were wrong to shift away from natural whole fats, right? You know, butter and the fats from animals, and switch to industrial polyunsaturated seed oils. So actually my book came out, it was one of the first, I think it actually was the first, calling attention to the problems with these industrial seed oils, especially when heated, all the inflammatory properties that come from that, and making the case that we had unfairly villainized these natural whole animal fats and that they do not cause heart disease. That's the major thrust of the book. And then in researching that, I came across a guy named Gary Taubes, who is a journalist, and he was writing about the low carbohydrate diet. And so I wrote about kind of the beginnings of the low carbohydrate diet, and because it's part of the fat story. So I came in through this studying fats, but it's part of the fat story because once you villainize fats, what do you replace them with? You replace them with carbohydrates. So if you think about it in terms of what you put on your plate, if you're getting rid of meat, if you're getting rid of, you know, cheese pies or whatever, you replace that with most likely carbohydrates, right? You're going to replace it with pasta, some kind of grain-based meal. If you replace bacon and eggs for breakfast, you're replacing it with cereals. So what, and it immediately makes you wonder, well, we did that as a society. We increased our carbohydrate consumption between 1970 and 2005. 15, I think, by some 25%. So we did as we were instructed. And what happened to health, right? So that's a correlation. It's not causation. But I started to chart the science. Starting in the early 2000s, there started to be experiments on subjects, human subjects from all walks of life with all types of diseases, saying, what happens if we reduce those carbohydrates down to the level, the best estimate that we were eating in 1965 was 39% of calories, right? Now we're told to eat 55% of calories as carbohydrates. So what happens when you reduce those carbohydrates? And the experiments were extraordinary, right? There were people were always losing more on low carb compared to low fat in every trial that you could find. They could normalize their blood pressure within a matter of weeks. They were starting to reverse all the symptoms of diabetes. And now we know there are trials that actually reverse a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. And so I've been following that scientific literature now for 20 years. There's more than 1,000 papers on just the clinical trial literature, which is the most rigorous kind of science that you can do. There's more than a dozen 2-year-long clinical trials. Again, rigorous science. There's a 5-year-long clinical trial. I mean, one of the things that I've done over the course of researching endlessly nutrition and health is looked at how many studies can I, clinical trials can I pull up for other diets, right? That give the same, and the quantity of literature behind, let's just say U.S. News and World Report, their top 10 diets, most of them don't even have a single clinical trial behind them. So you have, I mean, I became convinced because the clinical trial research is enormous. So there's now just a large body of science behind low carbohydrate diets. So for people who don't know the difference, their low carbohydrate is, I mean, ketogenic diet is sort of a more extreme version of usually under 20 grams right. of carbohydrates a day. But we wrote a paper about how that summarized all the literature and argued that this really should be one viable option in our government's nutrition policy, particularly for people who are suffering from these diseases, you know, obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, hypertension, heart disease. So, you know, I just became convinced by the science. It took me, you know, a while to change my own diet. That's a whole separate story. It took me some time, but the science really convinced me.
So, you know, arguments against keto are you're going to be tired, you're going to break out with acne, you're going to experience fatigue, you're going to increase your cholesterol, you're going to increase your heart attack risk. Let's do the cardiac thing first. What is the evidence that going on a ketogenic diet is going to be bad for your heart?
So the main piece of evidence is this this sign that your LDL, your so-called bad cholesterol, will increase for some people on a ketogenic diet. Often that is accompanied by their increase in saturated fat consumption. Some people, what they have found now in the 5-year findings that were presented last year at the American Diabetes Association, that was the so-called VERTA trial that was headquartered at the University of Indiana, involving hundreds of patients, at 5 years, they found that that rise in LDL cholesterol was transient. In other words, it resolved and went back down to normal. And at the same time, all inflammatory markers, I think they measured some kind of like at least 28, 29 other markers for cardiovascular risk, all of them improved. So what you have is, I mean, there's a lot of focus on LDL because we have, I think, drugs to treat it. But, you know, if you have 29 other cardiovascular risk factors going in a different direction, you have to assume that that diet is not worsening your cardiovascular risk. And there's also a study, there's a smaller trial that by Dr. Tro and his group that did an employer-based program where they found that cardiovascular risk score, as calculated by the American Heart Association, they increase life by, I think it was 13 years by putting people on a low carb or ketogenic diet. So there's quite a lot of data out there now to show that nearly all cardiovascular risk factors improve in this diet and that the LDL cholesterol rise, which worries people so much, is transient.
And I would say that there was a JAMA article, I think dating back 18 years, called the A to Z trial. And, you know, it found what we called at that time the Atkins diet, because Dr. Robert Atkins was this way out guy telling us we should eat more fat and cut the carbs. Crazy idea. And, you know, across all the parameters, including C-reactive protein, his diet seemed to be the best. Despite the popularity of all the other diets. You mentioned keto for diabetes, and I would just want our viewers to consider watching the interview I did with Dr. Sarah Hallberg discussing the actual reversal of type 2 diabetes going on. I mean, dramatic findings in terms of that VertaHealth program that you just described. And, you know, it brings to mind the notion of treatment for diabetes. Mainstream medicine does not have any treatment, none whatsoever, for diabetes. In fact, I asked an audience of mainstream doctors this several years ago in New Jersey, what's your go-to treatment for diabetes? And hands went up, and there were, you know, various drugs that were talked about, well, metformin or, you know, various other types of drugs. And I said, well, the fact of the matter is that those drugs are not treating the diabetes. They're lowering the blood sugar, but stop the drug, and 2 days later, what happens? You know, that's not it's treating the smoke and not the fire. I've said that. My viewers are probably tired of hearing that. But what you're doing with a ketogenic diet is you're correcting the underlying metabolic dysfunction. In this case, as it relates to diabetes, the insulin sensitivity is restored, allowing your body to handle it on its own. I got this. I don't need drugs anymore. And it's so sad that, you know, mainstream medicine is watching TV at night and people are thrilled because they got their A1C below 7 as if that's some kind of accomplishment because they're taking injections or they're taking pills. And by and large, I think to appeal to a broader audience, many of the people in these advertisements are perhaps a little overweight so that people can feel they're not stigmatized, they're part of a club. And it's all related. All these metabolic issues are strongly related, though I think mainstream wants us to compartmentalize these issues. Diabetes has nothing to do with hypertension. Well, as a matter of fact, it does. And dyslipidemia, they're all functioning in the same way as a response to these dietary missteps that we have been convinced to take. And again, you know, that's sort of right out of your playbook. It's what you've talked about for so long. You had a famous now, on the internet, debate, you're going to love this, with Dr. David Katz. So do the setup for that debate for us. Let us know who he is and how that played out, because it's, I believe, one of your shining moments.
Oh, that's very nice of you. I mean, Dr. David Katz, so even before my book was published, Dr. David Katz, who at the time led a center associated with Yale University, he wrote an attack column on my book even before it had been published in the Huffington Post. And then he proceeded to write a series of attack columns aimed at me. And he used to call me, he called me a wing nut and I must be hiding in my mother's basement. And you know, it's been a while now since I've thought about this, but, you know, an enemy of science. And
yeah, that's professional.
It's really, you know, really professional. So it turns out when I looked into this, who knew Dr. David Katz, he was, had received hundreds of thousands of dollars from I think it was Nestle, Quaker Oats. I mean, he had been funded by every junk food company you can possibly imagine. Actually, there's a pretty good blog on him called Junk Food Slyest Defender that was put up on CrossFit some years ago. But he, you know, he had all these junk food companies at his back, and he was the person that had been unleashed to attack me. And he did this over the course of years. Eventually, I had to hire a lawyer or do something. I mean, I've done this numerous times now in my career, but to get him to stop smearing me because, it was libelous. And then he started to call me, you know, the butter, meat, and cheese people of the world. And that became sort of my pseudonym. Anyway, at some point, the person who runs something called Soho Debates in New York City decided to put on a debate between us, and we went back and forth and agreed to a set of terms over many, many months, right? What was going to be the question and what he was going to debate versus me. And, you know, I'm not an expert or skilled debater. So I think that I did all right in this debate, but he had clearly been extremely well prepared. And what he did was, it was a very clever, he ran out the clock. So just talking about this or that. And then in like the last 5 minutes, he clicked through about 75 studies. Like, you couldn't see the headlines, you couldn't see the authors, but this was all supposed evidence for his point of view, which was, his point of view, I should have said at this outset, was we should be having, mostly vegan diet, right? He's with the Eat Lancet folks, eat mostly plants and very few animal foods. So this was like, his evidence was like as if you took a 200 page thesis and just dumped it at the feet of your advisor and it hadn't been stapled. So all the sheets go everywhere. And you say, this is my argument.
What a metaphor. Jeez.
And you're like, well, maybe it's a good argument, but I wasn't able to see a single thing. I can't read this or understand it. So I struggled to respond to that, but which was kind of a very disingenuous approach. And he was being coached on the stage because I could see the text messages going furiously back
and forth. Oh my gosh.
And he also stacked the audience, which we knew because, you vote before and after whether or not you've been convinced by somebody. And we could see all his fans cheering him and meeting him afterwards, but I'm not complaining. I mean, it was good to meet him in person after so long. And I don't think it did him any favors ultimately, because what I was able to do in my presentation was to list his many, many conflicts of interest now enshrined on the internet. And I was able to list his many disparaging, completely unprofessional comments about me. And not too long after that, actually, he lost his position at Yale.
He was aggressive with, in a very derogatory way, with respect to Grain Brain. And over the years has been pretty aggressive, though I think his position may have tempered as of late. But I remember I was going to be on CBS This Morning, and I got a heads up that they were not going to be embracing me on this morning show the night before I'm at dinner. So I wasn't back on my heels, and everything started off real lovey-dovey, friendly, welcome to the program. Dr. Perlmutter, this is when I revised Grain Brain 5 years later. In your revision of Grain Brain, you're again calling for us to reduce our processed carbohydrates and sugar. And then the individual talked about how she had a cupcake for breakfast or whatever it was. And Dr. Perlmutter, and then they quoted a quote from David Katz. But even then, we reached out, the transparency. We reached out to the sugar industry. This is on live national television. And they told us, they put up a picture of a chocolate chip cookie. They told us that sugar in moderation is no threat to our health. And how do you respond? And I said, it's like when the tobacco companies used to tell us that smoking was good for our health.
Just a little bit. And right.
Just a bit. And I have that. I play that clip actually quite often when I lecture, because, they made it very easy for me. I mean, they showed us what's motivating. Let's face it, television and what is vetted on television and news is really, again, focused toward the bottom line. And that would be their advertisers, who would, be very upset should there be somebody on the program that talks about why we should limit our consumption of the very products that are supportive of this network. So it's never easy. Let me go back to a couple other questions of keto, because I know many of our viewers are deep into keto. How is keto for weight loss, for example?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because the clinical trial literature, let me just cut this a few different ways. If you stack up low carb versus low fat experiments that pitted those two diets against each other, people always lose more weight on low carb, always. And that's a consistent finding. However, How much more weight do they lose? Well, when they the one study I know of that tried to quantify that came up with a pretty small finding that it was only a couple of pounds difference. I don't know if what was what they did with their study selection or how they came up with such a small number. So the clinical trial literature doesn't support that diet as being vastly superior than low fat. However, I think the clinical experience that doctors have with this diet is that people who are able to sustain it, right? It has to be sustainable. It's not something you do for a little while and then go back on. People who can sustain it, and typically that means sustainability involves joining a community, having support, especially for a diet that's so unpopular and unpopular with your friends, family, and doctor, you need support. Those people really do lose truly significant amounts of weight that are considered impossible currently in the obesity, the expert obesity community. So, you know, I'm talking, I mean, Dr. Tro, a doctor I mentioned before, was a, who's a large practice now outside of New York City. I mean, he says his 100 pounds plus club, people who've lost more than 100 pounds, is now over 1,000 people. So this is not captured in the clinical trial literature, but I think it is what physicians who are skilled at guiding people through this diet with health coaches and the like are finding in their patients. And, you know, why does it work better? It works better because I would say the top reason is that it is satiating. People are not hungry on that diet. All diets fail at 6 months because people cannot go forever being hungry. Nobody can. Read the starvation studies. People cannot deprive themselves of food for that amount of, you know, for more than a few months, really. And so they start to regain weight. But a ketogenic diet, which provides protein and especially fat, those are satiating. And you can sustain it because those foods are definitely satiating. Now, I mean, we could get into the also the topic of how hard it is to quit sugar addiction, carb addiction. Those are also issues. I mean, there are big issues around changing diet. It is not easy. But what I would say about the ketogenic or low carb diet is that it's the best possible solution we have come across that for a nutritional approach. I'm not talking about drugs. I'm just saying in terms of what you can do with your diet, a ketogenic diet is by far the most promising approach. So, and can I address the mortality issue a little bit?
You may, absolutely, okay. Yes.
So that's actually, you know, this idea that despite your losing weight, improving cardiovascular risk factors, reversing your diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, that you would shorten your life in the long term, even though, you know, what do people die of in America? They die of those diseases. So it seems counterintuitive that if you reverse all those diseases, you would then have a shorter life. However, there's a number of observational studies that had that finding. And I will just say, I reviewed them all for this paper that I mentioned earlier on a review of low carbohydrate literature. They all define the low carbohydrate diet inaccurately. So they just define it as 40% of calories as being low carbohydrate, which is inaccurate. It has to be, if you're talking percentages, it has to be 25% or fewer calories to actually have the kind of impact that you'd like to see. And further, those observational studies all, you know, capture populations really before the low carb diet even became something that we can measure. I mean, we don't have significant populations following that diet until maybe 15 years ago. Even with Dr. Atkins, I don't think it was such a significant portion of the population. So they're really not capturing accurate data there. And they're not referring to a low carbohydrate diet. And I think, like, we can't have this conversation without recognizing, again, like, what are the larger corporate and political actors in which we're having this conversation, which is there is so much advertising, media, pharmaceutical advertising, big food company advertising, as you said, on television, everywhere, that is pushing these ideas that this diet is dangerous. Why? Because they sell the high grain sugary products. They want to keep people with their double stuffed Oreos eating, you know, those foods. They want to tell them the little bit is okay. Just everything in moderation. And then on the back end, the pharmaceutical companies, they make their money by selling you those, you know, pills for each and every one of your conditions, or devices.
And now Ozempic.
Or now Ozempic,
for diabetes, to help you lose weight.
Projected to be the, you know, maybe the biggest blockbuster drug of all time. So, you know, one can't be really too cynical about what their motivations are. And so we're in this, that is our climate of having these conversations. I mean, if you don't think that they are able to get their stories in the media and able to, I mean, just look at the rollout of Ozempic. It's, you know, on 60 Minutes, right. There's 1,000 articles all over the media that comes from the power of pharmaceutical money driving that through the media.
So, that's right. Because it's not necessarily approved for that, but yet through the media, i.e. their entree into 60 Minutes, you're correct. You said something, and I just want to reiterate it. You said you can't be too cynical as it relates to this, meaning it's beyond what we can even get our arms around in terms of how deep it goes. The White House Conference on Hunger, Health, and Nutrition was purported to be this very large coming together of, you know, from various sectors to come up with a plan. It hadn't happened since the Nixon era. What was your takeaway from, you know, what transpired and how that has influenced policy moving forward?
Yeah, that was a conference last September. It was shrouded in mystery is the main headline, I would say. It was, you know, there was still no agenda, no detailed agenda. There was no bios on any of the speakers. There's no summary of the conference that, you know, is publicly available. It was, nobody knew who was invited or what was happening there. It was a very mysterious conference. It was driven by Tufts University, it was very close to the USDA, has a USDA center at Tufts, and they had done the major task force work that that led up to the conference. And the dean of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy, somebody named Dari Mozafarian, had been the top advisor to that conference. And so it really is unclear what came out of it, except for there. Well, it's not entirely unclear. There were a number of proposals to basically expand our dietary guidelines to more people, more places, more nutrition education. I should say, you know, in this conference's favor, it focused on nutrition as an important part of resolving diet-related diseases, which is something we all agree upon. I mean, that is absolutely, most certainly true, and that had not been a conversation that people in nutrition and health had really had, remarkably.
Connecting, oddly enough, just connecting nutrition to health.
You know, I like to say,
aside from,
yeah,
go ahead. The role Tim Ryan, you know, and being shot down years ago by George McGovern, but what a notion. What a notion that the foods you eat have a role to play in your health. Quick story. Our dog was losing his fur. We took him to, I went with my wife, take him to the vet. And the vet walks in and asks my mother, what are you feeding Tico? And my wife responded. And I looked at the vet and thought, how does she come out and ask this question? What if I, seeing patients, ask them what they're eating, which I do, of course, but what a crazy question. The first thing you ask is, what are you feeding your dog? And that's what you'd expect at the vet. Of course it is. What's the food? But not in humans. You know, what drugs are you taking? And what more do you need?
Yeah. And you know, and the issue there is just that I think doctors really have, you know, learned helplessness. It's not that they're not interested in nutrition, but they've been told and they prescribe a diet that is designed, has been shown to fail. I mean, so of course they don't believe in diet, even though they feel they should advise it. But you're right. We don't talk about the diet part of diet-related diseases. So this conference actually did put the spotlight on that important component. Unfortunately, the answer was, let's do more of what we've been doing. And the dietary guide, let's push out the dietary guidelines even more, even though, again, that's the, you know, 6 servings of grains a day, 10% of sugar has been demonstrated to produce obesity and diabetes in America. And, you know, what we need is a dietary guidelines that actually functions well. Instead, they're pushing out this policy that has been demonstrated to fail. So that was part of it, was let's have more government and more in our nutrition. And another part of it.
That's a good plan.
Yeah, because the definition of sanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
Right. And the definition of status quo, according to Ronald Reagan, is the mess we're in.
Right. So, and then the other part of which was very mysterious, but there was, I think maybe $8 billion invested in pledged investments. And when I went into this nutrition sector, but there was no list really of what they were. And when I started to look into just some of them, they were almost entirely fake food companies. So, you know, we're developing fake cheese, fake seafood, fake this, fake that. And that is clearly another corporate play, which is delivering to people to try to replace natural foods with these highly patent protected industrial foods that are, you know, have much higher profit margins for all the investors. So that's really another kind of investor corporate play. And in fact, one of the major drivers of this conference was a group of investors who, you know, it's arguably they're seeking to create new markets for their investments.
So I have two friends who attended, who were invited, and I've asked them what went on, and they're hiding anything, but I don't think they know what went on. I don't think they walked away. You know, you go to a conference, say, this is the goals, this is what we accomplished, and I haven't heard. I'm still waiting. I will say, interestingly, several of American physicians, including myself, were invited to speak to the then Prince, now King Charles, several months ago, who wanted to address this exact issue. How can we interface, meaning England, how can we interface with industry, with the principles that we are espousing to bring about better health as it relates to England? It was an interesting discussion. And, you know, he's become king, so he's been a bit sidetracked, but I think we're going to pick it up again at some point in the future. And maybe England will lead the way and demonstrate lowered healthcare costs, lowered healthcare expenditures as it relates to the diseases that are related to food, which is basically every chronic degenerative condition that you can think of, you know, ultimately based on dysregulated metabolism. Well, listen, I'm looking at Unsettled Science. What is that?
That's in my news column that's hosted by Substack. And I'm writing whenever I have a chance to.
I know that feeling.
Yeah. I covered the White House conference. I've done some other pieces. I hope to do more. But I think they're really, when I look out on the landscape of nutrition journalism, what I see is almost no critical reporting at all. I see nobody's following the money. It's an interesting thing about why we know so little about this field, where you're talking about, let's say, a $10 trillion market for food and pharma. Well, some people know how to follow the money on pharma, but, you know, on food, the nutrition writers tend to come out of the lifestyle sections. They tend to be cookbook writers. I mean, they're not journalists really looking at a massive industry. And so there just aren't stories on, there aren't investigative stories in the field of nutrition. People think it's something.
Well, I think both you and Gary Taubes have done an exceptional job. And, you know, you're both at your heart science writers. And by definition, you're looking at facts. So, you know, the two of you have really, really educated all of us, you know, the people who are in positions of implementing. And it's been extremely helpful. So, again, Unsettled Science, where do we find Unsettled Science?
You can just
not metaphorically. I mean, where do we find your
you can
column?
Find it everywhere, David.
That's true. Yeah.
So maybe you can just put it in the show notes. But if you look up Unsettled Science and some part of my name, I'm sure you can.
Okay, we will do that.
Great.
I love spending time with you. I applaud you.
Thank you.
Grateful that you're here doing the work that you're doing, and I look forward in a couple of years or maybe sooner, we'll get together again and see what you're up to at that point. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, David. It's really a pleasure to talk to you. And I'm grateful for what you're doing out there too.
You bet.
Great.
Bye for now.
Take care.
So how cool is Nina? I mean, she is out there fighting the fight. She has a deep belief that our lack of dietary fat and our dependence upon dietary refined carbohydrates Both are conspiring to bring about ill health, and I think the science is absolutely supportive of what she is telling us. It's great that there are people out there getting this message out. Her message has certainly gained an incredible amount of traction, and she has served for all of us as a mentor in many, many ways, and I absolutely applaud the work that she's doing. So again, her book, The Big Fat Surprise, is still very, very valuable. I would certainly take a look at that and follow her on social media and on her platform as well. Thank you, Nina, for joining us. And thank you to all of you who've joined us today as well. I'm Dr. David Perlmutter, and I'll be back soon. Bye for now.